You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Welcome to Washington Post Live and another in our series, Election 2024, The Stakes, co-produced with the Capehart Podcast. And I am Jonathan Capehart, Associate Editor at the Washington Post. Joining me today, third-term member of the House of Representatives, Congressman Ro Khanna of California. Congressman Khanna, welcome back to Washington Post Live.
Jonathan, thank you. Always good to be with you. In my fourth term, actually, believe it or not.
Oh, your fourth term. See, you know, I never get that right. I'm always like, 2 years plus. How many, when was he elected?
We had coffee when I first got here, and I always appreciated that.
Of course. Well, Congressman, let me get your reaction to a brand new, literally within the last hour, maybe even the last half hour, exclusive report from John Hudson, national security reporter at the Washington Post. And I will read you this key paragraph. The United States has quietly approved and delivered more than 100 separate foreign military sales to Israel since the Gaza war began October 7th, amounting to thousands of precision-guided munitions, small diameter bombs, bunker busters, small arms, and other lethal aid, U.S. officials told members of Congress in a recent classified briefing. I would love to get your reaction to this news just coming out from the Washington Post.
Jonathan, it's wrong. I mean, first of all, the administration bypassed Congress. I mean, you usually have to go through congressional approval. As you know, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and I asked Secretary Austin. I said to Secretary Austin, when will you commit to stopping the transfer of weapons if human rights violations are happening, as is required by the recent presidential memorandum, NSM 20. The president came up with a policy, I think in late January, saying we have to first certify that there's no civilian casualties taking place in a indiscriminate way before we ship further arms. So I don't know if this is after that policy that we continue to ship arms, but I'm really concerned. I don't think it makes any sense to have a policy where we're airlifting food into Gaza and at the same time providing precision missiles to kill women and children in Gaza.
What recourse, Congressman, does Congress have now that this has come to light?
Well, I think we need to have an immediate hearing in the Armed Services Committee about what authorization the president used. Is this consistent with his recent national security memorandum? There are two memorandum at play. National Security Memorandum 18 requires that before the president ships any arms, he makes a judgment that it won't violate human rights. But he updated that and had National Security Memorandum 20, which actually requires Secretary Blinken to first get a certification and certify that none of the weapons would be violating human rights. That certification hasn't happened. So we need to ask when these were shipped. Are there going to be future weapons being shipped? And I don't understand how, on the one hand, we've got the vice president. I was glad for an immediate ceasefire. And on the other hand, the administration continues to ship weapons.
I want to come to speak more fully about the Israel-Hamas war. I was going to talk about Super Tuesday and the State of the Union, but we're just going to push that aside right now and just talk more about this. You mentioned the vice president calling for an immediate ceasefire there in Selma on Sunday. And to take the deal, telling Hamas to take the ceasefire deal that's now on the table. A senior administration official told the Post over the weekend that Israel has, quote, basically signed on to the elements of the arrangement. So what is the sticking point for Hamas?
Well, first of all, we need to be Hamas, and we need to be pressuring Bibi. And I wish we had a call for a permanent ceasefire with the release of all the hostages months ago. I'm glad that the administration is now calling for an immediate ceasefire, but the sticking point, and I do believe Hamas should take the deal, and we should be pressuring Hamas to release the hostages. I mean, that should be unconditional. You don't just get to keep people's as hostages, but we also should be asking them to take the deal. I mean, so there's a lack of violence heading into Ramadan. The sticking point, though, is that the negotiators from Hamas are saying they want a permanent ceasefire. They want at least 4.5 months. Bibi has not gone past 6 weeks. And my view is that the administration should call for a permanent ceasefire with a release of all the hostages, in part to call Hamas's bluff. I mean, if Hamas is not willing to do it, even if the ceasefire was permanent, we know that they are acting in complete bad faith. Part of the excuse that they're making is, or the rationale they're giving is they want longer than 6 weeks because they don't want the bombing to resume right after Ramadan.
Well, do you think a deal can be reached by Monday, which is the first day of the holy month of Ramadan?
I'm hopeful, but I believe that the administration needs to do more. I mean, obviously, they're doing a good job in pressuring Hamas to take the deal. And I do believe having even a 6 week pause on the violence is better than nothing, because 6 weeks would give time for further negotiation. And maybe we can get that extended. But my sense is if the president and the State of the Union calls for a permanent ceasefire with a release of all hostages, that will help because maybe we can negotiate. Maybe it shouldn't be 6 weeks. It should be 2 months if Hamas wants 4.5 months. And I think that will help. I think he needs to make it clear to Bibi that we're not going to continue to protect him at the United Nations. I mean, three times the United States has been the only country vetoing a ceasefire, standing apart from 14 other countries. At the very least, we need to abstain. And I think he needs to make it clear to Bibi that there are not going to be future weapons transfers until this war ends.
Before we talk further about Bibi, which is the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, let's talk about Benny Gantz, who is a member of Israel's war cabinet. He came to Washington. He might even still be here, but he came to Washington, had a meeting with Vice President Harris and other senior administration officials in defiance of Prime Minister Netanyahu. What do you make of that visit?
I'm glad that he's coming here and talking and expressing gratitude. I mean, one of the most galling things to me has been this president has stuck his neck out for support for Israel, and he's being insulted by people like Ben-Gvir. Total lack of gratitude, lack of deference to the American president. So at least Gantz was appropriate and recognized the role that the president has played in standing up with Israel after the brutal October 7th attack, which we all condemned, most of us condemned, in unambiguous terms. And the recent UN report about the sexual assault that took place is horrifying. I mean, I read through that. I mean, that was a brutal, horrific attack. And President Biden unambiguously condemned that. He stood by Israel. I called for it, said Israel had the right to get the Hamas perpetrators after October 7th. The problem is that Gantz is part of an extreme right-wing cabinet that has gone and bombed, in President Biden's words, indiscriminately, where you have, according to Secretary Austin himself, over 25,000 Palestinian civilians killed, where they bombed refugee camps, they bombed hospitals, where they're defying our own administration and going into Rafah, where they're blocking aid in northern Gaza, and it's being reported that 500,000 Palestinians face starvation. So, you know, he may be more polite, but he's part of an extreme right-wing government that is carrying out policies in defiance of the United States. It's like someone in the Trump administration may be more polite, but ultimately is saying yes to Donald Trump.
You know, as you well know, in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, President Biden flew to Israel, literally hugged Benjamin Netanyahu right there on the tarmac. At the time, people observed that action as being part of a strategy to keep Bibi close in order to have more influence over Israeli war plans. And time again, we have seen Netanyahu publicly push back on or outright reject advice and proposals made by the president on military strategy, humanitarian considerations, and diplomatic solutions. And these two men have known each other for four decades. I'm just wondering, is this friction personal or is it political, given Netanyahu's own domestic considerations?
Well, the president's decision to bear hug Netanyahu was a mistake. President Obama had a much more coherent foreign policy towards the Middle East, which said that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state, but Netanyahu is an extremist who is expanding settlements, who wants ultimately annexation of occupied land, and that we need to have a Palestinian state and to end the occupation. And President Obama talked about this in his Cairo speech in the New Beginning in 2009. He had deep empathy and understanding for the Israeli narrative, an understanding of Jewish biblical claims to the land and the need for Israel as a Jewish state post the Holocaust. But President Obama also had deep understanding and knowledge and empathy for Palestinian claims and has spoke out clearly against the occupation and the need for a Palestinian state. In fact, under his administration, Palestine got observer status at the UN. The US voted against it, but we didn't block it with the same way. And I have said, I think that President Biden needs to reach out to folks in the Obama administration, people like Ben Rhodes, Tommy Vietor, others who have a vision for how we can recognize a Palestinian state and Israel. And he, frankly, should, in my view, consult President Obama because there was always some of the people on the Biden team critical of Obama's approach, where he was more publicly critical of Netanyahu. They said, let's bear hug Netanyahu and we'll get more from him in private. That policy has failed.
Should the president do more to address the Israeli public directly to convey the risks and costs of Bibi's strategy? One suggestion has been that President Biden should address the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Should he do that?
I think it's actually an intriguing idea, because I don't think that the way Bibi has conducted this war, Netanyahu has conducted this war, has been in Israel's own security interests. I mean, he's losing world opinion. I mean, no country wants 14 countries voting against them over and over again at the UN. He's losing Democrats and young voters under 50 in terms of turning them off. Most of them who were deeply, deeply empathetic and sympathetic to Israel on October 8th, who believed that Hamas was clearly in the wrong. It was a horrific attack after, probably the worst after the Holocaust, who supported Israel's right to get the Hamas perpetrators. But given how Netanyahu is conducting the war, he's losing an entire generation. And I think the president has an opportunity to make the case that it is in Israel's security interest to now have a permanent ceasefire and release of hostages, to have a summit in the Middle East that calls on Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, the UAE, to discuss the future of Palestine, a Palestinian state, not with Hamas, but with some of the civic leadership in Palestine, the municipal leadership, the next generation leadership. The Saudis, as you know, Jonathan, don't want Hamas, the UAE doesn't want them, Jordan doesn't want them, they're connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they could say, Saudi could say, we're going to condition redevelopment funding on Gaza on a new generation of leadership. The president could be a peacemaker. And this is ultimately, last point, I know I'm going on a little long, that this is ultimately in Israel's interest, because as Fareed Zakaria has said, Hamas is not just fighters, and there are 30,000 of them that Israel still hasn't killed. Hamas is also an ideology that armed resistance to occupation is better to the alternative. We have to show that the alternative is better to armed resistance.
And, you know, President Biden has his own domestic considerations when it comes to the Israel-Hamas war. We saw the consequences of this last week during the Michigan primary, the Democratic Michigan primary, where a protest uncommitted vote garnered more than 100,000 votes. Right before the primary, you went to Michigan to meet with members, prominent members of the Arab community there. What did you learn on that trip?
I learned how raw, how emotional, how much grief there is in Dearborn and the Muslim American, Arab American community. I met with Mayor Abdullah, Mayor of Dearborn, who's, by the way, one of the most innovative, dynamic leaders aside from this issue, a brilliant young man. I met with the majority leader of the House, Representative Aliash Abdul El Said, who ran for governor. They talked about their formative experiences at the age of 4, 8, going to a rally for justice against occupation and for a Palestinian state. And then they talked about how they know family members who have been killed, how they know entire families with 3 generations who have been killed. They didn't really talk about the politics. They talked about needing a change of policy that would recognize the humanity of those suffering in Gaza.
Let me read you something from Charles Blow's column in the New York Times on his trip to Dearborn, Michigan. I'm going to read part of it. He writes, the head of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations said he doesn't like Trump and doesn't welcome a second Trump term, but he's prepared to accept that outcome for the sake of punishing Biden. Quote, I'm going to live under Trump because I survived under Trump because he's my enemy, he says. I cannot live under someone who pretends to be my friend. He believes that proving a point about the power of the Muslim vote is worth it. Quote, is it going to be painful 4 more years under Trump, he asks. I say yes, and we are bracing for it, adding, at least what I have accomplished is, I told every politician, don't take us out of the equation because you will miss. When I read Charles's column, it was chilling because the idea of punishing President Biden at the risk of a second Trump term, I think is I don't agree. I don't agree with that. And so, Congressman Khanna, what is there anything President Biden can do to turn that sentiment around? Can he win Michigan if he doesn't?
I do think he can turn it around. And look, Jonathan, you know, I've been out there campaigning for the president in Michigan and New Hampshire, South Carolina, California, my home state. And I say that I am very critical of the president where I disagree. Just on today's podcast, I said he needs to follow more of Obama's policy, and his policy with bear hugging Netanyahu has been a failure. And they still have me as part of his team. They still take my phone calls. Do you think Donald Trump would care at all about what someone like me, let alone the progressive movement or those who are so infuriated at Netanyahu, would think? Absolutely not. And so at least with President Biden, we have someone who's willing to listen. We have a team that's willing to listen. And that gives me hope that we can move policy towards more justice. The fact that both President Biden and Vice President Harris used the word ceasefire over the last week is a shift in policy. That word used to be taboo in this town. Now, I agree it's not permanent, it's 6 weeks, but the point is that should give hope to all of the organizers out there that their voice is being heard, that their voice does matter. I do think, though, we need a few bold statements from the president that could help us win back not just the Muslim and Arab American vote, but young voters, progressive voters, particularly voters under 40 and voters on college campuses. And that is, he should clearly, in my view, recognize a Palestinian state and say his second term, he's going to work towards that. He should call for a permanent ceasefire and a release of all hostages and make it clear that he's working to end the war. And he should be clear in condemning the occupation. And I think if he did that, it would help us win back trust from this coalition. One final point, Jonathan, this idea that we can just target the disaffected Republican suburban voter and win, losing the coalition, is wrong. Go look at pictures of the turnout of Barack Obama 2 days before 2012, not the Hope and Change campaign, the campaign against Romney. I saw one in Wisconsin. There's a sea of humanity, young people, people of color, people from college campuses. We need that to be able to make sure President Biden has a second term.
Let me bring in a provocative audience question from Florida. This comes from Brian Labovic from Florida. Doesn't the political cost question that Israel is splitting the Democrat vote, well, we changed it to Democratic vote, due to a small minority in Michigan, throw our democratic principles to the wind? Does it discount to zero the large majority of the Democratic Party and general national sentiment that Israel is a free pro-American democracy and should be free to defend itself against Hamas, and place a small minority of far left liberals at the center of the party? Do you follow
that?
Let
me say where I agree and disagree with Brian. Where we agree is that this decision should not be driven by electoral politics. It should be driven by principle. And my, you asked me what the consequences are electorally, so I answered. But my belief is that we need a permanent ceasefire and release of hostages because that is the morally right thing to do. Look, I agreed that Israel had the right to defend itself and get the Hamas perpetrators who committed the brutal October 7th attack. I condemned unambiguously, unequivocally, the rapes and sexual assault that Hamas committed on October 7th. But I thought Israel would go about it like they did with the Munich incident in the Olympics, where they took years to get all of the people accountable. But I did not think that Netanyahu and his far right wing government would just start bombing indiscriminately, in President Biden's words, hospitals, refugee camps, and defying the United States, defying the United States. So no, I don't think that if Israel is going to get our weapons and come to the American president for help, that he or she should be able to defy the American president, nor do I think they have the right to be indiscriminately bombing in ways that are at best callously indifferent to the lives of Palestinian children and women.
Another question comes from Daniel Reagan from Indiana. If President Biden is the party's nominee in November, what advice do you have for those citizens who oppose Trump but have deep concerns with Biden's A, Gaza policy, and with B, his age?
On his age, I think it's more about a person's values than their age. And my view is that you don't have two people who have more starkly different values than Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I can tell you from my interactions with the president as recently as 2.5 weeks ago on the Middle East in a rope line in South Carolina, he is perfectly cogent, coherent, thoughtful, on top of it. We need to make the case to him for a shift in policy. Let's focus on that. But these gratuitous and political attacks on his age just don't have a bearing in reality. He is immersed in the details, and his values are, I think, what matters. On Gaza, what I would say is, look, this is a president that has always been open to listening. He is a president who understands the diversity of opinion, and we need to continue to make the case to him that he can help make history by recognizing a Palestinian state, by working towards peace, that this should be critical to his second term agenda.
Aside from Israel and Gaza, what do you hope to hear from the President of the United States during his State of the Union address, which will be perhaps the single biggest audience he will have throughout for the rest of the 2024 election cycle?
Well, first, I hope he'll bring the same energy and spark that he brought to the last State of the Union address, which in my view was one of his best speeches in his entire public service career. I mean, it was phenomenal. And you had the diverse Democratic coalition celebrating it. I remember Jamal Bowman from the back seats yelling, "Mr. President, that was phenomenal." So he had energized our party, and I hope he'll do the same. And then second, I hope he offers a forward-looking vision for America. Yes, talk about some of the accomplishments, but you know what? People don't want us patting ourselves on the back. Talk about what he's going to do in his second term, about rents that are too high, about the costs of childcare, about raising wages for folks, about continuing to bring manufacturing back. Offer his vision for the nation and a forward-looking second term agenda.
Well, Congressman, well, shouldn't he pat himself on the back? you look at the polls, and it's mystifying to me whether, especially the numbers on the poll numbers on the economy. You know, all the indicators are pointing, are green. in terms of wage growth, job creation, so on and so forth. Oil production, which is, you know, lots of folks on the left don't like, but it's still, you know, a positive economic indicator. And yet when folks are asked who's better on the economy, Donald Trump outpolls the sitting president, outpolls President Biden. What do you make of that disconnect?
Well, it's shocking to me, too, because I think the president has had a very strong economic record. But I would say two things. One, we had inflation for 3 years. Now, that inflation was caused because of COVID, because of pandemic shocks, because of spending that started in Donald Trump's administration and was necessary and continued in Biden's administration. We don't talk about the fact that most of that spending, a lot of it, was under Trump. And I defend it because we needed to give people checks. We needed to make sure that the unemployment rate came down. And President Biden, fortunately, also made sure that we weren't going to have massive unemployment. But the reality is that for 3 years, prices went up and we don't have disinflation. So the price of groceries is high for folks. The price of rent is high for folks. And wages have started to go up over the last 6 months, but they have not kept up with all the accumulation of costs going up. And that's why I think you have people anxious. And then you have the bigger issue of people anxious about the American dream. You know, my district, Silicon Valley, $10 trillion of market value. NVIDIA hit $2 trillion the other day. The world seems the oyster for a lot of young folks. In other parts of this country that faced deindustrialization, that faced economic loss, young people say, I can't buy a house. I don't know if I'm going to have a good paying job. This American dream seems vanishing. So the president, in my view, has to speak to the fact that there's still a lot of economic anxiety there. We have a lot more work to do. He understands the future economy, where we're going, and he understands how we're going to give people a shot. In some ways, like FDR did in 1936. You know, FDR did a lot, but he spent 80% of his speech in 36 talking about how the country still needed a lot of things changed. And then President Biden should contrast it with Donald Trump.
Congressman, in the 2 minutes that we have left, I'm curious about something. Earlier, you said that the president in his reelection, basically, I'm paraphrasing, tend to the base, make sure that the base is energized and excited, and don't try to go for disaffected Republican voters, suburban folks. And I only bring that up because sometimes you go on Fox News. And you try to speak to people who don't agree with you, and you try to break through to new voters, which I applaud. I'm just wondering, are things so hardwired in this country now that does it work?
Well, I appreciate that. I wouldn't say don't go after disaffected Republican voters in the suburbs. I would just say don't make that your micro-targeting only strategy
your
and
focus.
Think that we can do that. Without also getting the base. And look, I don't want to keep quoting Obama, but he did both, right? I mean, he inspired and helped build this incredible multiracial coalition of young people. And yet he'd also go into factory towns and Republican towns and he'd speak with respect. And he'd say, you may disagree with me, but I'm here to listen to you. And I want to bring this country together. And he would listen with empathy without compromising his values. And I think Democrats need to do that. We need to inspire folks. We need to inspire the younger generation. But we do need to go on Fox. We do need to say, look, we understand that people may have a different view. And we understand why people are angry at a system that hasn't worked for them and try to win back people with respect and temperament. I'm hopeful the president can do both. You're never going to have another Barack Obama, at least for a while. But as someone said to me, Jackie Robinson was the greatest, but there are a lot of players who came after him who had better stats. And my hope is that, you know, the coalition that we're building will allow that.
Congressman Ro Khanna, four-term congressman from California's 17th District. Thank you very much for coming to Washington Post Live.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.